meet them there. They would, the mayor would come and talk to them. And my father was very active there. Several attorneys, a kind of an interesting sidelight on the old attorneys. They were not men and decrepit and handicapped by lack of training. Those old attorneys, they were named, one was named Sarity. Sarity looked like an Italian. It was Wycliffe. He looked foreign. There was Clarence Jones, a graduate of Ohio State. There was a man named, let's see, I'm trying to think of those. Well, I'll come back to them, but all of these men were very capable men. And the interesting thing about it was nearly all of them that I remember looked like white. And this was the lawyer colony during that day, black lawyer colony. Now, I don't know whether that was because the fact that they were fair is because the Bar Association was favoring them because of their color to represent the black community or not. But it was just strange that all this whole group, or another man I left out was named Nash. All these men were handsome black men, but all looked like white. And they represented the community.
Do you remember like ways that they were talking about organizing? Like you were saying that a lot of the issues were centered around the city employees.
Yes.
And what were some of the issues, and what were some of the ways that people were trying to organize to?
They wanted jobs. Mm-hmm. The only kind of job, a city job, was open to a black was a street sweeper. And they wanted somebody on the force, police force, someone in the fire department. A fire department appointment was so rare and singular that I remember the headline in the black newspaper about a man being appointed to the fire department. That's how rare it was. And I remember that would be in about 27 or 28. And let's see. Well, you kind of leave the subject now.
Well, so you were saying the only jobs open were being a street sweeper for the city. What were some of the other jobs that African Americans held during that time?
Well, my father was in the post office. The post office job was very representative. And my father was a mounted carrier, and there was a man by the name of Randolph and Spencer. All these men were from New Orleans. My father was instrumental in helping them get jobs in the government. Then the most sought after, more or less luxury job was a head waiter at one of these fine clubs. And I used to hear of the University Club, and the L.A. Athletic Club, and clubs of that nature. I remember there was a head waiter that was very, very popular in this town named Parker Lee, and there was a group of young men. In those days, they were 35 and 40. Fine-looking guys, well-dressed, guys who did very well. They were used to the social necessities and how to dress and so forth. Because they kind of stood out as a group, and they were clandestine. And they were an elite. They were waiters, but they took on all the mannerisms of the people they worked for. And that was the crowd, the black crowd in Los Angeles, but these were waiters, and that was
the kind of elite.
Yeah. Oh, and you had your chauffeurs, and your chauffeurs were something that you don't see today. For instance, at 3 or 4 o'clock after close of a business day in Los Angeles, your main streets like Hill and Broadway, and your office buildings, you'd see the big limousines drive up and fire. And you could look down the street and they would be parked, catty-cornered, and you might see 100 or 200 big, fine automobiles, all with livered chauffeurs. And this is kind of a past thing now. You don't see this anymore, especially the liveried chauffeur. But all these, and they would stand out their car, hold the door open for the owner to come, and you got to know certain individuals as being the chauffeur. Somebody, for instance, there was a chauffeur, well-known chauffeur by the name of Cliff Bennett, and he happened to be the chauffeur for one of the Bennett women, and so everybody knew him as almost a member of the family, Ben, and that's the way it was in those days.
You were talking about Central Avenue before, you know, in the teens, and you were sort of going down, and you got to the Black Forum, the Forum.
Yes. Now, after the Forum, the avenue had progressed as far as 9th Street. From then it went on down to 12th Street with the opening of a big barbershop right on the corner of 12th and Central. The Hooper Avenue streetcar used to come down 12th Street. It would run from Main down 12th Street East, stop at 12th and Central, but it stopped at San Pedro and 12th and those way, and go all the way down to Hooper Avenue. And then it would go out Hooper Avenue to 52nd Street, where that would be the end of the line. So when the center was right there at 12th and Central, and it filled in, they had nice business places, you had a drugstore. Mr. Henderson had a haberdashery at the corner of 12th and Central. J.C. Smith had a drugstore right next door. Doctor's offices on the northeast corner. And you had a big grocery store on the southeast corner. Then Central started, blacks started moving down toward Pico. Then they went all the way down to Washington. Now, in the meanwhile, they were buying homes and so forth, and as they moved down, whites moved out. They got to Washington, and they jumped to Adams, business places, but the earlier business places along 5th and Central became taboo. They closed down. They got lost out in the race. So from then, when you got down to Adams, they jumped to Jefferson, and they stayed around in Jefferson, 35th Street, 36th Street for a long time, and then they went to Vernon and Central. That was the borderline. And
which borderline of this Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm.
When you said that was the borderline,
that is, the whites were on south of Vernon. They were all whites
in the city of Vernon.
No. Vernon Avenue.
Right.
Yeah. So there was a time when blacks did not live any further than Vernon, and that lasted a long time.
That was that part of the restrictive housing covenant? Was that?
Well, we hadn't reached that yet.
Oh, okay. We're back in the 20s now.
They were just
okay.
This is where populations were just pushing other people out. Restricted covenants were affected by changing circumstances. So when although some of that property was restricted, the change in circumstances was so strong that they weren't being enforced in those, but there was a certain rigidity at a certain point. Now Vernon was the rigid, the place of rigidity. This is where, well, it's not going any further. And that's the way that happened. Then they jumped. They jumped gradually, one by one, one by one. Persons moving in, moving. They took over as far as Slauson. At Slauson, and by this, Slauson, about 1930, the fighting started there. Not real fistic fighting, but maneuvering. Real estate people trying to find openings for plots. My father, being a real estate man, sold a piece of property on 58th Drive, just east of Central, to George Godfrey, who was called the somebody from Libreville. He was a world champion fighter. And they would not let him move in. The whites would not let George Godfrey move into the house. My father had to take the house back. I remember going out there and going in the property with my father and a group of other men with all with guns to protect that piece of property. 1213 East 58th Drive.
So what year was that?
I'm trying to think. George Duncan was living. It'd have to be in the 30s. Early 30s.
So what was happening there? Mr. Godfrey was trying to move into the house. He had bought the house.
My father took it back. There was no fighting about the house there.
Right.
It was my father took it back, and my father had it on his hands.
As a realtor.
So, yes. And so that's when this thing, 1213 and a half East 58th Drive, that's right down now in the Spanish Belt. Once it broke there, it went right on straight through on Central. And then you had the restrictive covenants being lifting all those restrictions. And then he started buying in other parts of the town. I remember when one of my friends, Attorney Townsend, bought on Arlington, and he violated the restrictive covenant enforcement. Lauren Miller was an attorney who handled a lot of those cases, and he got great help from similar cases in other cities. And of course that's been all brought out in the books, like St. Louis, Missouri had a similar case, Detroit had a similar case, where they attacked together restricted covenants. That's about it.
So what were some of the ways that people got around the laws and, you know, were able to live in areas that were restricted.
Now, what? Say that again.
How did people get around the laws? Like you were saying, you knew somebody who was able to buy in an area that was restricted.
Here's what they do. The owner would want to sell the property, but the owner, there wasn't much of a market other than blacks, and the owner, his neighbor said, "Man, don't sell, because they once come in, they'll take over." So it ended up that they would clandestinely sell anyway to a black, but the black would have to take the risk of trying to live there. And
what were the risks?
The risks were whites attacking them. getting out in front of the property and shooting into the house, or putting signs all out, and tearing down shrubbery, breaking out windows. It was very serious. And I grew up with that. I remember seeing that. It, interestingly enough, though, it didn't cause hatred. It was growth. You, when you're born with something happening like that, then you're kind of used to it. See what I mean? And for instance, if you have to go back to something that never existed, that'd be different. But this, these are the things we were raised with. I was, for instance, if say I would go in to get a drink at a kind of a friendly drugstore, and you run into somebody who you'd never seen there before, but everything had been very friendly up to now in this drugstore, and some guy would walk up to you, some guy much older than you, and you were just a kid. You say, "Nigga, what are you doing here?" Well, you're not going to respond as you probably would today, because you had other things like that happen. You grow up to accept these things happening. So I ran into a lot of that. I must have been sensitive. I never once ever went into a white restaurant, to even though everybody else was going. This is how I felt about it. I just didn't want to take a chance of being humiliated. And it was the hardest kind of thing to get me to go into a restaurant like that, even long after I graduated from law school. See, I don't think I must have been at least 40 or 45 before I ever went into a white restaurant.
So, when you were growing up, you lived Shuson Park, Rose Hill Park.
Yeah.
Which was a predominantly white area.
Yes. Also German.
And German. Was your family affected by that when you, because before when you were talking about, you know, the things that would happen in the neighborhood, how they would react when blacks moved in, was that any kind of a problem for your family?
My mother had a knack of getting along with people, and her intelligence, don't forget, she was a trained woman at that time, and she graduated from normal school, and she was superior in mentality to these people, and she didn't have to confront any great big strong minds. And when she did confront them, they became antagonists. And I remember in the neighborhood there were certain people that stood out as being very formidable, and there was kind of a guarded peace between them, and they didn't communicate with each other, my mother and these people, and we just knew where those people lived. But my mother, and meanwhile, was very friendly with there's a lady right across the street from us named Martinez, and my mother was back and forth, and the next door neighbors were very, my mother was very close with them all, so didn't have any problem. But this same neighborhood, during World War II, this same neighborhood was so prejudiced that they, of the whole state, hung a sign over the boulevard at Rose Hill Park, over the Huntington Drive, with a great big sign, "Japs don't let the sun set on you here." Now that's the kind of locality we're in. That's the kind of locality I grew up in.
And how long did you live there at that house?
Oh, I lived there till I went away to school.
Oh. So really, your whole childhood?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I stayed there. That means that I was about 1932. I left city, and I was there all that time.
During this time, were there certain areas of town that were like that were black communities? Or was it mostly
Central
just
Avenue.
Were people mostly interspersed or integrated
Central
in other areas?
Central Avenue and its environment was the black community. Another community developed on the west side, and that was between Budlong and Western, and Jefferson and 37th Place. That was another black community.
And they called that the West Side.
Right.
Yeah.
There was another street, a couple of streets, that had black residents. That was down Catalina, around 24th. And I remember Catalina in 24th. It was, they were, for instance, fair Negroes were set themselves up in on certain streets, and they didn't have any problems because I guess they didn't know what they were, black or white. But there were always certain other blacks that we knew were living in white districts, and there's never any question, but usually they were very fair people.
Yeah. Did people try to pass? I mean, you know, if you were fair?
Yes, we knew some people. We knew a lot of people that passed and then went on over. You never hear from them again. Lots of them. We knew, well, there was at least 50 families who insisted on being black. That it must have been very embarrassing to them because they all look so white, more white than the white, that to insist on being black caused them a lot of trouble. And certain families just, who were blondes and so forth, we could hardly believe it ourselves. Like Walter White of the NAACP, I don't know whether you ever read it. Well, the man that more or less went on down and cracks lots of things that are happening in the South. Blue eyes, blonde hair. He was a black man. There was gangs of them like that. Like some of those attorneys I told you about. Yeah.
Would there be a certain respect, you know, if you could, respect for those people who could have passed but, you know, insisted on retaining their identity as black?
Well,
or was there a certain resentment if you passed and sort of were never heard from again? I mean, what?
I don't know. I guess the thing had happened so long and so much, we're all inured to it. These are just facts of life. We didn't particularly think too much of it. There was a family. Gillespie's. There's a family of Gillespie's who lived. They lived over on West 53rd, out that way. Lived there for years, and no one ever raised any question about them. The daughters married black men, and that was a well-known family. I guess there are about 10 families I know that just everyone knew about how fair that I suddenly caught off then because the name almost came to me. But there was also a group, there was a group of people who exploited the situation. That is, they could play both sides of the fence. So if they went, say there was, there might have been as many as 400 or 500 blacks who were very fair, could go anywhere, and they would. And they would go out in groups together to have a black face among them would have exposed them. So that a clique developed, and their parties would be that way, and everyone was aware that this was going on. And like a fellow, a young man, old man now, was telling me the other day that he went to a funeral, and one of these very fair ones passed away, and they were all, when he walked in, he's brown skin, and so he asked the usher, where do the blacks sit? And he was laughing and telling me about this the other day, and this is the attitude now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There are groups among us. There, this situation has run into certain universities around. There was a famous black women's college that was more or less noted for that, and that brown-skinned girls had a hard time getting in. This is what caused all the reaction about black is beautiful, because it was more or less a fight, an outspoken fight against such attitudes. And we all, we've seen so much accomplishment from both sides of the fence that now we're pretty well integrated. If anything, the brown-skinned person has the advantage in society because he doesn't have a lot of enemies. Now, there are some people who just hate one another. See, there's prejudice among blacks just like there's prejudice among whites. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
That's it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You
got, by the way, you've got to learn to live with it, too. See, you, in your conversation and every day, this is one of the things that you discover. You, one individual, can say something to a group of blacks and it would be regarded as an insult and they would resent it. Another individual can say the same thing as a big joke. And it isn't based on color. There are some certain light, freckle-faced, reddish-looking white boys that can walk up to a group of very sensitive black guys and call them niggas and some of them bitches and things like that, and they just love him. This is the phenomenon about things. Loving. Red, they call him Red. There's lots of Reds around the country. On the other hand, you can take some guy who say the same thing and they want to kill him. So I guess it's the approach and the tack, or at least they have grown to understand and to evaluate a guy. One guy might be very smooth in his statements and so forth, and they might feel that innately he is very prejudiced, but he's just not revealing it. And then they want an opportunity to expose him. But it's you have to be tactful out here.
Where did you go to junior high school and high school?
I went to high school, Lincoln High School, on North Broadway, over by Lincoln Park, and I left for there and went to USC High School on the campus of the University of Southern California.
Oh, uh-huh. So that was sort of like had one for UCLA too, like
yeah,
University High?
Right.
Yeah, it was like
right.
That.
It was more or less a teacher's academy for students in education.
Is that what you were studying? Were you studying to be a teacher at first?
No. I mean, the ones who were teaching were teachers of in the future.
Right.
And they, and we, this place was more or less set up for the University of Southern California for its athletes, who they wanted to guide through school and might have problems, so they sent them to USC High School.
So what was Lincoln High School like? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was a tough semester system type school, and I learned this when I first went there. I expected to continue my relationship with the white students that I had associated with in grammar school. We had to go way over a hill about 3 miles away to this high school. So when I sought to run and buddy with the same ones I'd been buddying at grammar school, they were very elusive. What few there were, there weren't too many. And it ended up that I started affiliating with the black students at the school. And it just so I was fortunate enough that they had some tremendous athletes, state championship members, and I got to know them pretty well. And one was the his name was Tommy Miles. Tommy Miles was a little short, yellow fellow. Had coarse squirrel-looking legs. He was a 220-yard champion, state champion. Henry Stapler was a big, light fellow, about 6 feet, was a 100-yard dash champion. Good-looking boys. And I formed a relationship with them that lasted. One of them I introduced to his wife, and the other one I buried about 8 years ago. So the relationship has been good all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when during your school days, what did you do on vacations?
I worked in the market, and I learned a lot about watermelons, and they gave me the nickname of Slim in the market, and we'd unload watermelons, these big Klondikes, from railroad cars, and then I graduated where they, these stall owners in this big wholesale market, put me to stacking watermelons, and that's an art. You have to learn to pick automatically the sizes of watermelons so they'll fit in on a stack and they won't roll down and crack. So that's what I did.
Where was that market?
7th and Central, and there was another one at 7th and San Pedro, 9th and San Pedro, and I worked in both of them. And so when a great big load of a truckload of watermelons that come from Imperial Valley or one of the other places, the first thing those stall owners have to do is unload those trucks. So you get a call out, get Slim or somebody and about three others, and you learn to pitch those watermelons. Each one you pitch about 5 feet. And it's very strenuous work. And you have to wear a wristband, because you pull your wrist out of socket. And you learn to, you learn how to catch, because you start dropping one, it hits your knee, you break it. And you can also eat all the melon you wanted, because you get all the cracks. I made money because I would unload and they would give me all the cracks, and I would take the cracks out in the boulevard, and you'd sell them and get big prices for them. By the way, melons in those days were only, you could get Klondikes, cent a pound. thing. So that you'd get a 30-pound melon for 30 cents. And you know what they run today? Yeah. So now on top of that, I worked I made a trip through on the freight lines and was a sailor's mess and on the it was a Luckenberg line steamship, Luckenbach, Luckenbach, and I went through, went all the way around to the Panama Canal, and I lived in Boston for a while, for about a year and a half, and was a ringer in the laundry back there, and because I had tried to get in Harvard, and they, Harvard, the chairman of admissions, more or less complimented me for having determination to get in, because I went back there, had been turned down before I went back, but I worked when we there and came on back, so I made the two trips to the Panama Canal.
This is before you were, or right around the time that you were graduating from high school? And
yes, right after I graduated from high school. That was about 20, I graduated about 26.
Yeah. And what were your ambitions at that time?
Say that again.
What were your ambitions? What did you want to do?
It was just mixed. I wanted to go in business. I wasn't thinking of law. And the Mr. Bellinger, when I married his daughter, and I knew he was in business, a similar business that I'd been in Los Angeles, I just thought that might have been the greatest opportunity to go down there. But my father didn't own the property he was selling. My father was selling on for a commission. And I was thinking that Mr. Bellinger operated the same way. Mr. Bellinger owned the property he was selling. So it was a kind of a different feel. The market, the opportunity in Texas didn't open up to be as much as I thought it would have been. And my professor there, a professor from Texas, he used to teach in the University of Texas, his name was Hallam, John Hallam, and he called me in one day and told me that he thought I had some talent. He said, but you're not going to like Texas. And he says, I understand you. He said, I know your father-in-law. He says, I think you better go back to Los Angeles. You'll get along better there. So, and he was right. Yeah.
So you did you go to the University of Texas for a while?
No.
Uh-huh.
No. I graduated from USC.
Right. First you went to USC? No, yeah. USC High School.
Yes.
And then you went to USC?
Yes. And then Ohio State. Both in arts, I went there for liberal arts first, and then I went on into law school. And that was it.
So when you were a college student, were you thinking, well, I'll just get my college degree, and then, you know, you wanted to get a college degree, but at that point, had you decided you wanted to be a lawyer?
No. No.
What was it that inspired you?
Found out I had aptitude for law. Did excellently in law school. I didn't make the first 10, but I was within the first 15 of law school. And I just loved it. And when I took the bar examination, I sailed through. I was number one leaving the room. I thought the exam was a setup. That made everyone think I was not going to pass it. But I finished early, and I felt real good that I passed, and I did pass the first time.
But before you decided to go to law school, you know, you were trying to decide if you wanted to go into business or what area you wanted to.
Had no idea.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea. I didn't mention to you, but that you were asking me about early occupation. I was at the corner of 43rd and Central when I told you that Vernon was becoming the borderline. They had an experiment. There was a big controversy then about putting blacks to work. So the people at the corner of 43rd and Central on both sides of the streets said they were going to hire blacks for the first time. So someone suggested my name to work in this chili parlor called Finley's. And it was a place where they served hot dogs, tamales and chili, all kinds of milkshakes and so forth. And they gave me the job. And it was just this gang of people who started coming in there. I knew all these guys. Lionel Hampton, I knew him then when he used to drink a great deal as a youngster. And his wife had come there. I would give them, they've served them and the orchestra members and build a fine relationship with a lot of young guys who were going to school. Things were broke just right before the Depression, and I had a lot of leeway there, and I was making money for the man, and to build up his business, he put me on nice hours. I go on at 6 p.m. in the evening and clean up to close up at 6 in the morning, 6 to 6, and got the magnificent wages of $16 a week. And that was good money then. And just before I got ready to go back, I want to leave there to go away to go to the university. He told me things were very rough, that my shift was making money, but it was only on making any money, so he cut me $2. I didn't get mad about it because I knew the man, I liked the man. And that man, his name is Mr. Finley, he happened to take a trip east about 2 or 3 years later. And he came all the way to Columbus, Ohio, and came where I was living there, going to school. And we had a good old heart-to-heart talk, you know. So I got along well with people.
Yeah.
And I liked the people. They liked me. Yeah.
So where were you during the Depression?
In the Depression, I was 32. And I was working up to that time at Finley's from about 1929 to 32 at Finley's. In 32 I left after the Olympics. I met some of the guys there, like a guy by the name of Gordon, Ed Gordon, a world champion broad jumper, and a guy like Albritton, high jumper, and formed good friendships with him. And that's what induced me to go back to Ohio State. The main inducement, though, was, you're going to laugh about this maybe, I was, by the time I'd already gone to USC and I became a member of the fraternity called the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, a black fraternity. And we gave a lot of social affairs, and here I was going entertaining and paying the expenses of these teachers who were coming out from all the states. This used to be a mecca ground for summer vacationers. So all these beautiful women would be coming out here from the various states, like, and they'd come from Cincinnati, St. Louis, Kansas City. And so on this particular evening, the thing that really got under my skin. I was taking this big, tall, delightful woman by the name of Angie Bell McNeil. I took her out, and we were talking seriously. Of course, and I was pretty confident I was making all this money of $16 a week. And she says, "Walter, what do you intend to do in the future?" And I said, "I don't know, but I had hopes and so forth." And she says, "How much are you earning where you're working?" So I told her about $16. She says, $16 what? I said, a week. And she says, "Oh, no." And I said, "Yep, I'm good. I got a little, they just cut my wages, but I'm not doing badly." And then I had nerve. I said, "And what are you doing?" She says, "I'm teaching in Cincinnati." And she said, "Do you know that's the best, highest salary teachers location in the country?" And I said, "Well, tell me this, what are you making?" She said, $22. I said, "What?" And she says, "But not a week." She says,